March the 1st, 1956, and the clock reads 6:20 p.m., a moment frozen in time. On the eve of Morocco's independence, as she should have been laying down in her bed, preparing to attend the celebration she's been invited to, alongside the royal family and social allies of the country the very next day, Touria's body lies cold on the ground, covered in blood in front of her parents' house on the streets of the Mir Sultan neighborhood in Casablanca. What started as a seemingly ordinary evening ended up turning into a tragedy that sent an entire family and community into mourning stage. Earlier that day, Touria Chaoui, the first female pilot in Moroccan, African, and Arab history, a successful young woman full of hopes and dreams, takes the driver's seat, her brother Salah Din by her side. The car glides along the city streets, its headlights casting a warm glow on the cobblestone roads. Above them, a friendly presence, the clouds, a sky she knows like her back pocket. It is clear with a crescent moon hanging low, casting a gentle silver light over the high buildings of Mir Sultan. As they're driving, Touria and Salah Din pass by street markets, butt heads with drivers. The city streets are alive with excitement and anticipation as people prepare for the historic day ahead. Tomorrow's a new dawn, a new day, a new life, a new chapter in Moroccan history, from Tanja to Lagouera. The air is filled with the sound of, well, cars mostly, mingling with the distant calls to prayer echoing from nearby mosques. Along the way, they catch glimpses of Moroccan flags fluttering in the breeze as reminders because, yes, tomorrow's the day where we get to celebrate self-governance. As they pull up near the house on 32 Rue de Bergerac, Touria honks the horn, announcing their arrival. But before she can exchange a word with her mother, a dark figure suddenly appears out of nowhere. In an instant, a gunshot rings out, shattering the peace of the evening. And 19-year-old Touria is the target of the bullet. Touria Chaoui, with her whole life ahead of her, is struck down by an act of senseless violence. As his sister's body lies cold on the ground, her brother Salah Din is frozen in shock, waiting for his turn for what felt like an eternity. But after that one gunshot, silence returns, deafening as ever. Their mother, Zina, who witnessed firsthand her daughter's assassination before her very own eyes, screams on top of her lungs. Her anguished cries pierce the stillness, echoing through the walls of Mir Sultan, begging for help. People rush to the crime scene, but upon their arrival, the cold-blooded murderer has already taken off into the night. Their faces twist in horror at the sight before them. Everyone is standing, stunned and speechless. Welcome back to Land of Mankind, a podcast that opens a portal to the realms of Moroccan history. I'm your narrator and host, Aya, I hope your favorite one, and in these episodes, I'll be taking you along with me as we travel through time to uncover the stories of the minds, places, and events that shaped Morocco. So if you're ready for a ride, allow me to take you back to the 1940s, my friend, a decade that had Morocco standing 10 toes down at the crossroads of history, dealing with the complexities of occupation, trying to balance out old and new, legacy and experiment, past and present, all in all to provide the country with the new definition of what it means to be Moroccan after decades of occupation. A definition that would preserve Morocco's essence while making sure it is fit and able to face the struggle of the century. Against the backdrop of French and Spanish colonial rule, Moroccan society was going through both social and political transformations. And as it was navigating the daunting currents of the protectorates and nationalism, the struggle for independence simmered beneath the surface. And underneath all of that turmoil, it was difficult to imagine worrying about anything else. And it was precisely that momentum that allowed for groundbreaking stories to be written, among which the rise of Touria Chaoui. In the grand scheme of human history, there are those stories that grab our attention, right? Not just because of their remarkable nature, but because they challenge our preconceptions of what's possible. Some things appear beyond reach until a bold mind envisions them. Some feats seem unattainable until someone shatters expectations. The large majority of people, including myself, in most instances of our lives, are quite indifferent to the things we get to be surrounded by and experience on a daily basis. The extraordinary fades into obscurity, blending seamlessly with the ordinary until it becomes imperceptible. And among these actors we take for granted as we let them rot in the back burner of our lives, the sky makes up for the most obvious thing we notice. So when most of us look up, right, all we see is a great cold blue roof over our heads that has never once failed to shelter the human experience. A barrier standing between the fragile scenes of our daily lives as human beings and the expansive, mysterious realm of the universe suspended in space. We see it as this unknown life companion we assume will always be there when we wake up and will never fail to look after us as we fall asleep. But when people like Turiya Shewi look up, they see it differently. While the regular person, like you and I, for example, we go about our days not really wondering how come we only got 2 feet and no wings, right? Pilots see the sky as this irresistible playground calling upon them. And so does the young woman you'll get to know throughout this episode. A young Moroccan woman born into a society where the notion of a female pilot seems like something out of a fantasy novel rather than reality. An idea that was met with raised eyebrows and probably a bit of skepticism, to say the least. And understandably so, since we're talking about an era where the Moroccan skies, like many other things really, seemed reserved to men. Yet, against all odds, she takes to those heights, defying social norms and expectations. Ladies and gentlemen, the life and death of Turiya Shewi. Born into the vibrant city of Fes, Morocco, on December 14, 1936, Turiya Shewi entered the world with a spirit as lively as the streets around her. Fes, the city with, arguably, one of the most dense cultural and historical heritage, provided the backdrop for Turiya's early years, shaping her into the determined young woman she would become. Despite the challenges that lay ahead, Turiya's birth in this ancient city symbolizes the beginning of a journey filled with resilience, courage, creativity, and unwavering determination. I might be overdoing it with the symbols, but you know that's my thing. You know how most girls gravitate towards dolls and cute toys? Well, according to her brother, Salahuddin Shewi, not Turiya. Right from the get-go, she had a thing for small mechanical objects. Cars, airplanes, toys. While many girls typically find joy in playing with dolls and traditional toys, Turiya diverged from her peers quite early on, according to her brother. This rather different taste for things was already hinting at a unique inclination towards mechanics, perhaps engineering, or as we know, aviation, and was kind of laying the groundwork for the trajectory she would embark upon later in life. Just like any child, Turiya's health condition put her parents through the wringer, and that happened quite early on. She blows out the candles on her third birthday cake, but instead of, you know, cake-filled wishes, she is grappling with an extremely uncomfortable chest illness, an illness that would return throughout her life in seasons. It was actually pretty serious. Her dad's beside himself, watching her suffer. He's like, "What can I do? Is she going to die?" Typical Moroccan parenting. But like I said, she was going through it. He makes a trip to their doctors in Fez, who literally drops a bombshell. The medical advice he got was pretty unique in and of itself. He says something along the lines of, "Take her to the airport, find a pilot, and let her fly high. That's the cure." Sounding like something out of a quirky, bizarre movie script. "Oh really, doc, is that all? No, the way I would have stormed out of that man's office, because what do you mean? Give me something, that's my child." But I guess when you're a parent, you would do anything. Only pretty obvious problem that wasn't anticipated by Mr. the Physician was that getting Turiya, a young Moroccan girl, during the European occupation on a private plane ride was like trying to fit a square peg in a round hole, essentially. The aviation training school weren't exactly rolling out the welcome mat for her. Not only did they not take her dad's request seriously, for a young child doesn't seem to have much business taking to the skies on a private jet, but they were French dominated, no less. So, you do the math, talk about a challenge. But, and you'll see that's a pattern that will just keep on repeating itself throughout her life, Abdulwahid Shawi is a determined man. He doesn't bat an eyelid. He's on a mission. He's like, what do you mean? My literal doctor says the cure to my sweet, sweet, precious child's illness is somewhere in the clouds, and y'all won't take her? Nuh-uh. Nuh-uh, brother. If you think I'm not taking her up there, you're tripping. You are tripping. I got prescribed a plane ride, and that's exactly what I'm going to get. You just wait here, Charlotte. Something along those lines. And finally, after a bunch of searching, he finds someone willing to take his child up for a ride in the air. And guess what? The doctor's unconventional remedy works like a charm, because Surya's health perks up. But, ladies and gentlemen, my dear friends, hold on to your hats real tight, because that flight did more than just appease her suffering. It ignited something inside her. A passion for flying that was about to define her entire life. Turiya caught the flying bug, and there was no going back from it. It's like she was destined to defy gravity from that moment on. So if we were to sum up Turiya's childhood, we would say that she had her head in the clouds, quite literally. She was captivated by the idea of flight, an obsession that was setting her apart from her peers. While many saw aviation as a man's world, Turiya refused to be confined by gender stereotypes, boldly charting her own course in pursuit of her dreams. But there's something that needs to be said about what allowed her to dream this big. Under the nurturing guidance of her parents, Abdulwahid and Zina Shawi, Turiya's upbringing was infused with intellect and progressive ideals. Their forward-thinking approach to parenting provided her with a solid foundation upon which to build her dreams. Growing up in an environment where curiosity was encouraged and boundaries were challenged, Turiya was empowered to really envision and see her future beyond the confines of social norms or standards. The walls of the Shawi household were echoing discussions of possibility and ambition, fueling Turiya's aspiration and instilling in her the belief that she could achieve anything she set her mind to. Abdulwahid Shawi, Turiya's father, was a man of multifaceted influence in colonial Morocco. As one of the first Moroccan French-speaking journalists, his words carried weight in a society where, unfortunately, language was often a symbol of privilege and power. He worked for the famous newspaper Le Courrier du Maroc, where he would write insightful commentaries on the social landscape of the time, the political scene, etc. Yet beyond his role as a journalist, Abdulwahid was known for his fervent contribution to the nationalist movement. In the context of the protectorates, his words would express resistance, would challenge the status quo, and champion the cause of independence. And as he was kind of splitting his life between all these different roles, he inspired his daughter Turiya to carve out her own path of defiance and determination. According to her brother Salahuddin Shawi, who dedicated an entire book on his deceased sister, Abdulwahid Shawi really made it a point to have his conception of education defy and challenge traditional gender roles by raising his daughter with an unconventional approach, to say the very least. He saw his daughter for what she was, not for what would be best for her to be based on external expectations. And I really don't think I'm overstepping here if I dare go off script a bit to say that he probably prided himself a lot for that. Clearly, the Shawi were showing off their kids. He didn't mind the gossip. Actually, turning his kids into trailblazers kind of was fitting the narrative he was after for himself, for his career, and for his involvement in the nationalist movement, which was very evidently balancing out tradition and modernity. Abdulwahid would give Turiya the same space he would typically reserve for his sons, and he would, you know, show her off. He introduced her to the worlds of theater and cinema, which he was very much a part of as an actor himself. Abdulwahid encouraged Turiya to explore her creativity and expression traditionally associated with masculinity at the time. But quite evidently, the Shawi household did receive a fair share of criticism. Not only was Abdulwahid associated with this image of a disconnected French-speaking Moroccan intellectual as a journalist and a theater guy starring in French movies like La Septième Porte, for example, but he was loud about his lifestyle and about his kids' education. He wouldn't even try to fight against that narrative. He was very secure, let's just say. Indeed, Abdulwahid Shawi wasn't just a man of words. He was was a man of action, deeply involved in the world of, like I said, theater and cinema. To this day, he is considered a pioneer in this realm, as he really used his influence to channel and promote and sponsor the Moroccan cultural scene during its burgeoning stages. And what pissed people off the most, including the so-called elite, by the way, was the starring of his 12-year-old daughter, Touria, alongside him in the movie. So it is safe to say, Touria's journey to the skies began long before she ever set foot in a cockpit. She found herself thrown into the spotlight as she starred in a film that captured the imagination of audiences far and wide, French-speaking obviously. It was actually there, with her father, under the bright lights of the silver screen, that Touria first tasted fame, an experience that very much predicted and foreshadowed the extraordinary path that was laid ahead of her. The fact that she found herself to be a target of, you know, conservative shockwaves must have been quite traumatic if we want to be realistic, but it also laid the groundwork for her to defy conventions and pursue her dreams with unwavering confidence. And she has her father to thank for that. Because in the face of criticism, Abdelwahid Chaoui remained steadfast in his belief in his daughter's potential, nurturing her talent and encouraging her to pursue her passions. Or at least for a while, her father's passion that became her own eventually, as he lived vicariously through her, through his progressive parenting. Touria's journey into, you know, the world of local theater production really allowed her to thrive by expressing, you know, her passion for performance, despite prevailing norms that often limited girls' involvements in such activities. Touria fearlessly embraced the stage, guided by her love for the dramatic arts and supported, of course, by her family's encouragement. Through each role she inhabited and every character she brought to life, Touria acquired a certain spiritual momentum. That kind of momentum that allows you not to take life so seriously, to be intuitive and attentive to your underground voices, the kind of momentum that prevents you from caring too much about others. In 1948, Touria embarked on a new chapter of her life as her family relocated to the city of Casablanca. It was truly a life-changing move, and I get that. I mean, they were leaving their comfortable, exclusive social circle in Fez, where the entire family tree is rooted, only to come face to face with the emulsion of Casablanca, an emerging and very troubled hub of culture, politics, and activism. Nicely settling into their new home in Mersultan 32 Street of Bergerac, Touria and her family found themselves immersed in a community of prominent nationalist figures, thanks to her father's contact list and his own engagement in the liberation movement. Because, quick reminder before I get ahead of myself, Morocco had been undergoing occupation from both France and Spain for decades at the time, though the Spanish were more established on the northern and southern edges of the country. The 1940s and 50s mark a pivotal period as Casablanca becomes essentially a crucible for the anti-colonial struggle. Less than a year prior to their arrival in 1947, the Darbat Saliran massacre stands as a reminder of the sacrifices that were made by those who dared and continue to dare to challenge colonial authority. And it gave life, so to speak, and some momentum to the nationalist movement, in the light of defiance and in the light of solidarity. From general strikes to acts of sabotage, they refused to be silenced. At the time, you could sense a profound shift within the intellectual elites of the nation. First of all, they weren't all rich, so that's a starter. Second of all, they came from very different educational and social backgrounds. Third of all, there were experts from very different fields, ranging from law to mathematics to Islamic studies, and they all played a pivotal role in shaping the trajectory of the independence movement. And at the heart of this transformation was a collective awakening, a realization among these intellectuals that true liberation could not be achieved through anything but unity and resilience. Many scholars, inspired by ideals of nationalism and self-determination and quite honestly fed up with the French, rallied behind the cause of independence, using their voices and platforms to mobilize the masses. They would reunite, engage in fiery debates and discussions, grappling with extremely complex questions of identity, history, sovereignty, freedom, and obviously they would be facing censorship, persecution, imprisonment at the hands of the authorities as an attempt to silence them. So we were in the thick of it. And soon enough, Tullia's home really wasn't hers anymore. It became one of the many, many gathering places for the nationalist reunions and discussions where they would share their ideals and plan, etc. So she found herself surrounded by individuals that were dedicated to shaping the future of Morocco, which was pretty stimulating, if you want my opinion. Tullia's upbringing in Casablanca was an exposure to diverse perspectives, to commitment to the cause of independence, and how could she not become just that herself? It made for some very formative years. Fast forward to November 1949. She sets her sights on new horizons. Horizons that won't necessarily be defining her future, but horizons that will propel her onto the life she was always meant to have. She secures a position as a secretary at the Moroccan Agency of Information and Advertising, with its headquarters located in 138 Boulevard de la Gare. If anyone listening is from Casablanca, then it's going to get out of de Lyon, the about probably, perhaps, maybe not. Well, literally, a couple meters next to it is where the magic unfolds for Tullia. In the middle of the hustle and the bustle of the agency's office, Tullia dives into her work, an activity that, you know, at least marks the beginning of her professional journey, even though she's not passionate about it. And yes, she had just turned 14. A moment of silence, everyone. Very different times, indeed. I am questioning my life. The agency organizes a literary competition to commemorate the Throne Day celebration, Eid al-Adha, a fairly new tradition that was established by the Sultan Muhammad ibn Yusuf, soon to be King Muhammad V. Remember, Tullia's curious. Tullia likes to study. Tullia likes a good challenge. So Tullia goes and seeks her father's permission to participate. But she has a condition. Listen, this is crazy. Like, she goes to her father, asking for his permission, and then she has the audacity to say, okay, so I want to do this, but for me to do this, you have to do... what the fuck, Tullia? So like I said, there's a condition though, a promise made in earnest. If she secures the prize, her father must enroll her in the prestigious pilot school, Les Ailes Chérifiennes, or the Chérifien Wings, located in Tetmelil. And that bet, my friend, was about to make for the beginning of the rest of her life. With her father's word as an anchor, a motivational background voice telling her to wake up, get at it, and win that flipping competition, Tullia takes on the challenge with so much grace, you guys, so much grace. And she's excited. She already envisions herself making her dream of becoming a pilot come true. A dream she always knew was hers, since, like we touched on previously, instilling doubts and fears and worries in his kids really wasn't her father's parenting style. He knows how to push her buttons just a little, just enough to make it work wonders. She succeeds. God, I wish I could have gotten my hands on the production that made her win, essentially, the contest, so I could read it to you guys. And believe me, I looked. Listen, to prepare this podcast, I went above and beyond. But I guess it wasn't that big of a deal in and of itself, just a private competition within the agency, I suppose, hence its lack of publicity. Abdelwahid Chaoui is a man of his word. He's also extremely influential, considering he has connections in literally every field you can possibly think of, ranging from politics to art to military to healthcare, etc., which, to be fair, isn't that hard to do for someone as involved in the rising nationalist movement as he was. So the Proud Father makes his network and contacts work for him and manages to convince the flight school attendant to give his daughter a chance. And it just so happens that his persistence, like most times, pays off. She's in. So together, father and daughter embark on a journey that took them all the way to Tetmelil, a small town in the outskirts of Casablanca, located southeast of the city. But upon their arrival, there's one problem, and a big one. The flight school staff and student corps aren't exactly warm and welcoming to her. See, here's the thing. The institution is catered to a specific type of graduates. If you see where I'm going with this, give me a white, give me a French, give me a male, give me a white French male. Not me, actually, though. Let's just clear that out. That's the genre of students the school is used to grooming. For the most part, I think we can also fairly add to the list arrogant, Eurocentric, obnoxious, given the reaction she got as she stepped inside the building with her bag and big dreams, was pure mockery. Her brother, Salahuddin Shawi, talks about it in his book extensively. See, here's the thing. Let me paint you a picture. Throughout the French protectorate over Morocco, a troubling trend emerged among French settlers, particularly the soldiers and administrative officials, and even industrials. Anyone. It was a habit of disrespect, a demeaning act that spoke volumes about their attitude towards the Moroccan people, particularly the women. Instead of acknowledging, you know, their individual identities, like, these motherfuckers would dismissively label any Moroccan woman they encountered as Fatma. Now, not that there's a problem with the name in itself, on the contrary, it's absolutely gorgeous. The problem was that some French settlers would literally call everyone by that name. It's just as if I was going around in Paris calling literally every man Pierrot, Pierrot, Pierrot. Dehumanizing behavior, extremely unsettling, disrespectful to the locals, but also emblematic of the broader power dynamics at play during that period. And Turia wasn't spared either. She found herself targeted by derogatory remarks, taking the brunt of that arrow aimed directly at her face. Now, surprisingly, the first perpetrator of that verbal attack on her was none other than the school's director himself, a man named Martin. Now, according to her brother, the principal would have said something along the lines of, "Listen up, folks, can you believe this? Little Fatma here thinks she's going to learn how to fly a plane." End of quote. After all, who ever heard of a Moroccan girl becoming a pilot? No one, so that's fair. But you know what they say, you forge bridges where others see voids. Sadly for these insecure men, and happily for us, and I'm being polite, the Shawi family doesn't really take no for an answer, and it runs deep in the DNA. In the face of Martin's mockery, Turia and her father stand unfazed. Let's face it, she probably cried for a bit. I mean, come on, she's 14. I would have been an absolute mess. But despite the laughter that fills the air, they firmly stand on business. And so, with her father by her side and her dreams soaring high, Turia Shawi takes her first steps towards a future where the sky is no longer the limit, but rather a chance to prove herself to herself and accessorily to others. And for her biggest cheerleader slash manager slash father, well, he was probably already drafting his next paper, titling something along the lines of, "The greatest victories are won against all odds." Or maybe not. You know what? Maybe he was just observing her closely flourish into the amazing, successful woman she was about to become. But I mean, come on, he's a writer. I would have done that. But getting into the flight school is just the first hurdle. The schedule is scheduling, no bullshit. Turia lives with her parents, obviously, who had moved with her to Tetmelil at this point, working to pay the school bills and transportation costs. So she wakes up before the crack of dawn, making the long journey to the academy, all for a shot at her dream. It is a daily struggle, but she is a tough nut to crack. She's resilient. She knows that the path to success really isn't easy, and her father is there to remind her of it whenever she gets distracted. Turia wraps up her training. She's doing good. She's thriving academically. All is well. She gets used to the skepticism and ridicule of her French male peers. They're jealous. That's fine. So what? Deal with it. But as graduation approaches and she's finally about to become the first female pilot in Moroccan history, everyone, she faces the ultimate challenge, which, in my opinion, had everything of a conspiracy from Mother Nature herself. She passes a flying test. Now, off the bat, you'd think, you know, nothing crazy or abnormal. It's just, whatever, student life. But it just so happens that no one anticipated the weather would turn out to be as dreadful as it was that day. Or actually, according to some theories, everyone did, except for her. Some say the French administration threw a curveball at her and purposefully chose that day to thwart her chances of graduating, which sounds crazy to us, right? It sounds crazy. But really, it isn't that outlandish of a take, considering she already was the black sheep of the academy. To pass her exam, 15-year-old Turia is compelled to drive an entire plane in the middle of a raging storm. And I know what you think, people do it all the time. But y'all, it's 1951, we're in Morocco, hell, she's 15! And to make matters even worse, remember the chest illness I told you about, the one she caught when she was 3, that got her on a plane for the first time? Well, it figured it was a good week to come visit. Now hear me out, if that was me in her shoes, right, next on the line to pass that test, let me tell you, I would have been like, listen, guys, this is clearly not working. Somebody's trying to warn me. دراري خوتي الأعزاز خليتكم على خير. كيفاش أشغل عاود؟ شنو قلتي؟ Pourquoi je pars? ورا باينة. مش ما... باش منشيش هاد الريحة. نسيتي حاجة كطيب في الفران، دونك غنمشي نتفعل هذا دابا قبل ما تحرق ليا. فهمتوا؟ دونك غنخليكم على خير. الله يسهل عليكم. يلا تلاحوا. Just kidding. Okay? Don't come at me. But Turia, no, she's certainly not one to back down. She's like, come on now, you've got to be kidding me. I've come this far, there is no way I'm turning back. She barrels ahead, defying the odds, flies through the storm like a fish in the sea, whoop, and nails that test like a pro. Earning her wings and getting her pilot's license in the process on October 17, 1951. Now, according to the historian Abdelhaq Al-Marini, it is said that the director of the civil airport had watched the whole thing. She was so impressive, he couldn't believe his eyes. Brother was like, whoa, and he went straight to her, practically in awe. So that kind of defeats the theory I mentioned earlier, or maybe it doesn't. Maybe they did want to pull a baptism of fire for her. Nonetheless, he would have allegedly scooped her up in his arms with respect and admiration before escorting her to the exam hall, where she aced the oral test like it was no big deal. That day, she took to writing, and despite all of this, she expresses in a heartfelt message addressed to her father regarding the exam how much she had enjoyed herself, a letter that can be found in the book of Abdelhaq Al-Marini, the kingdom's historian. She writes, Baba, I experienced the happiest moment of my life during that flight. I felt an overwhelming sense of confidence and assurance. There was no fear of failure clouding my mind. Amidst the fog, all I could see was clarity. I navigated the skies with utmost care, ensuring the plane's balance remained intact, never straying beyond its limits. In those moments, I felt like a bird, flying alongside my companions with feathers completely free. The hum of the plane's engine served as my only company, guiding me forward with the wisdom of my knowledge and experience. End of quote. No wonder she won that literary contest. Now let's fast forward to 1952. Turia, she got her flying certificate, she's making waves, shaking up the whole aviation scene. She's not just the first female pilot in Morocco, she's taking the entire air board by storm. You remember that storm? Yeah, she conquered it and became it. And she's not just the first female pilot in the Arab realm, which is already pretty impressive in and of itself. Turia Chahui becomes the third woman in human history to ever take up to the skies in the 1950s. And here's the kicker, she's a mere 16-year-old. Embarrassing, Martin! You embarrassed yourself! How dare you question her? Oh my gosh, talk about breaking records! With her groundbreaking achievement, she becomes the talk of the town. Hell, the entire country! Or at least those who've heard about it on the news. Because, you know, people in Morocco, they like to talk, but this time it was pretty positive. I mean, you can't possibly ignore what's in front of your eyes, can you? And this young woman was making history in front of theirs, so Better keep them cracked open. As if by magic, Touria Chaoui's name spreads like wildfire across newspapers, both in Morocco and abroad, while messages of praise pour in from every direction. Literally everyone is obsessed with her. She receives congratulations from Lel Fassi, a prominent figure in the Moroccan nationalist movement known for his eloquence, defense of Arabic language and Islamic culture, and bold activism against French occupation. She even receives a warm message of encouragement from none other than Abdelkrim al-Khattabi himself when he was in his exile, an unparalleled leader of the resistance initially against the Spanish and then the French imperial powers in the Rif region of northern Morocco during the years 1921 to 1926. Other people who expressed their support to Touria were the King of Tunisia, the King of Libya, the Algerian and Tunisian Women's Union, etc. Like, so many people. Touria's achievement didn't just turn heads locally, it made waves globally. Women's organizations from far and wide took notice of what she had done and extended their heartfelt congratulations to her. Her accomplishment garnered attention and acclaim on a global scale as newspapers from different corners of the world were buzzing with her story. Though we can argue that some narratives were a bit questionable, I'm not gonna lie, even slightly too politically oriented for my liking. But that's only natural considering how divisive her storyline can appear as it is, depending on the point of view. It was more than just recognition. It was a symbol of hope, of possibility for women everywhere. Touria proved that barriers could be broken no matter where you came from or what challenges you faced. Though I have to say, looking back, there's one thing, one nuance that I failed to see in the narratives that were getting spread. And it's probably one of the most important pieces of the puzzle. The reason behind the absence of limiting beliefs in this young mind that allowed for space to cultivate talent, the reason she was able to explore professional opportunities, didn't feel pressured or talked into conforming to societal norms and rules in any shapes or form, the silver lining of her strong self-esteem and work ethic, is truly the remarkable forward-thinking support system that was backing her up. One could argue it might have been tougher, if not entirely impossible for her to take that leap in other circumstances. Circumstances other women and even men, to be fair, with the same dreams, were finding themselves at the time. There's an entire dimension where she wouldn't have had her family's rock-solid support or anyone who would be blindly believing in her potential like her father did. That's what every single child deserves. And the fact that we get to see an example of that in the 1950s, no less, is truly amazing to me. But let's get back to the story. Sure, Touria Chaoui's breakthroughs resonated far beyond the borders of Morocco, inspiring people around the world to strive for greatness, no matter the odds. But perhaps one of the most touching gestures came from Jacqueline Auriol, a renowned French test pilot. She didn't just send Touria a simple note of congratulation, which she could have, but rather she sent her a photo, a symbol of solidarity and support from one pioneering woman to another. Because Jacqueline Auriol is no less than the second female test pilot in France's history, so she knows what it took to get there, what it takes to be there, and what it will take to remain and keep at it. It was a powerful reminder that the kind of achievements Touria was making on the other side of the Mediterranean weren't just personal victories, they were moments of triumph for women everywhere. Moments that would break down generational barriers. Now, they probably didn't know that yet, but we've seen the result, we've seen the consequences. It paved the way for future generations of young girls. And so Jacqueline Auriol made sure that Touria knew she was right where she was supposed to be, despite this special place being a male-dominated field that can sometimes be challenging, not to say hostile, towards women. It is only a way up from here for Touria before it goes downhill, but we're sticking with the good things here for now. Pretty soon, Turiya finds herself rubbing shoulders with royalty, posing proudly beside the late Sultan Muhammad Khamis in a snapshot destined for the history books. He receives her with great hospitality, accompanied by Princess Leyla Amina herself. And as she becomes a fixture in royal circles, opportunities start aligning. Speaking of Leyla Amina, the daughter of Sultan Muhammad bin Yusuf, she gets approached by her institution for young girls' education, an administration that saw in Turiya exactly what they needed to be the cover front of their foundation. Fired up with a passion to shake things up, she jumps feet first into her role as an ambassador for the Leyla Amina Institution, throwing herself wholeheartedly into the cause. Now, it looks all rainbows and butterflies on the surface, but let's take it down a notch for a sec, shall we? It's important we be real with ourselves, as much as I'm sure the monarchy was impressed by her exceptional abilities as a pilot. I'm sure sponsoring her involvement in the institution wasn't just a casual, uninterested decision, but a strategic tool, no less, to shape their image, sensing an opportunity to bolster it and align themselves with the aspirations of the people. Let's say the royals happily embraced Turiya as a symbol of modernity and female empowerment at a time where Morocco not only was trying to negotiate independence, keep that in mind, but also to prepare for what would come after that. The social disruptions, the need to curate an image internationally, etc. So behind the grand gestures and public displays of support lay a well-rounded, calculated strategy to benefit from, you know, the attention Turiya was getting for political gain, and there's nothing abnormal or evil in that. That's just politics, isn't it? But it is important to keep in mind, nonetheless. By rallying around her, the monarchy sought to present itself as a soon-to-be progressive state on the condition it was granted its independence. So this is why I told you to keep the fact that beneath the surface, or actually like very much on top of it, Morocco is still struggling with independence, which had the monarchy in need to bolster its legitimacy and to find a way to contain the winds of change sweeping across the nation. As Turiya awaited her audience with King Muhammad Khams at the palace, the atmosphere was undoubtedly charged with anticipation and reverence. For Turiya, I can imagine the prospect of meeting the monarch would have been, you know, exhilarating and nerve-wracking. A nice little mix of both. She might have felt a mixture of pride and humility, knowing that her accomplishment had earned her this moment of recognition. Perhaps she stood a little taller, her heart pounding with excitement as she rehearsed in her mind what she would say when the king extended his congratulations. I mean, sometimes you just wish you were a fly in the wall, and for me, I wish I was one. The day Turiya met the Sultan for the first time, because, you know, he's an extremely rare private figure, unlike his successor, who was notorious for his public appearances, displays of authority, and a certain degree of availability with the Moroccan people. Now, Sultan Muhammad bin Yusuf, his father, was very much not like that. I can only imagine what the attendants within the palace walls were whispering among themselves. For them, witnessing this teenager, essentially, a young woman with her suit and tie, receive congratulations from the Sultan must have been something, a moment of pride and inspiration, yes, perhaps, a reminder of the potential for greatness that lies within every citizen of Morocco, sure, or perhaps they didn't think much of it, and I'm just projecting what I would have thought, that also works, but I just think it probably was an odd scene. Now back to the Leyla Amina Institution. Was actually, for the fun fact, opened in 1950 and impulsed by the Benjeloun Touimi spouses themselves. Now, if you're Moroccan, my friend, listening to this, you know who they are. Mohamed Benjeloun Touimi is actually the founding father of the football club Louided. The Leyla Amina Institution had Turiya really invested in societal causes. She founded within the institution the Sisters of Charity Association and made for a fervent advocate for women's rights, even though the movement and its actions were extremely slow, let's face it. Her activism extended to the national stage, and I'll be covering that in an upcoming podcast episode, but the women's rights movement in Morocco was actually born in the nationalist ranks. And remember, Turiya Shoei is used to that scene. Her father being an active member of the group himself, he would often hold receptions at their house in Sultan, inviting the most prominent figures of Moroccan nationalism to discuss the struggle for independence. So it was only natural that she rallied against the protectorates, using her newfound international fame to demand the return of Mohammed Khams from exile. Let's open a bubble here. Now, that wasn't always the case, but at a certain point in time, realizing how much traction and momentum the nationalist movement in Morocco had been gaining, the Sultan Mohammed Khams, or Mohammed bin Yusuf as he was called, or Sidi Mohammed even, gathered enough political courage to start calling for the immediate political emancipation of Morocco from the European protectorates. In 1952, during Eid al-Arsh, the throne celebration, the Sultan delivers a stirring speech and expresses up front his support to the nationalist movement, setting off a chain of events that led to his removal from power. Now, by doing so, he kind of set off a seismic shift in the political landscape, a shift Paris refused to acknowledge. But that's on them. History doesn't wait. And as tensions simmer, the stage is set for upheaval. Later that year, on December 1952, worker riots start breaking out across the country, especially, guess where? Yes, you guessed it, Casablanca, where things took a bloody turn, triggered by the assassination of the Tunisian unionist Farhat Hashid. For the colonial administration, these riots become a convenient excuse, a pretext to ban all nationalist movements as well as the Moroccan Communist Party. With the Party of Istiqlal being defeated, the Sultan's grip on power weakens. Behind the scenes, a shadowy plot is in motion. Anti-emancipation forces start uniting, including not only the French administration, but also influential Moroccan leaders. Among them, how can I not mention the name of Lubesha Tamil Glaoui, head of the powerful Glaoui family, which I will be making an entire separate series on with different episodes because there is just too much to say about this guy. The French authorities had grand designs for Morocco, envisioning it as a Franco-Moroccan state that could, if they waited just enough for their policies and administration to blend into society, become a potential new Algeria. That was frankly the long-term vision for most of the empire. The Sultan's future hangs in the balance as he's pressured to give up his throne. The French have a plan. They want to replace him with his cousin, Mohammed bin Arafa, a puppet they can pull the strings of with zero effort. This guy, listen. They know he'll nod along, sign whatever they shove in front of him without so much as a whisper of protest. This is the kind of guy Mohammed bin Arafa was. A weak leader, essentially, that's what he was. But despite their efforts to calm things down, nationalism keeps bubbling up, and that makes them nervous as hell. So on August 20th, 1953, the deposed Sultan Sidi Mohammed bin Yusuf and his family are sent packing, first to Corsica and then to Madagascar. But the French administration didn't expect for things to get as wild as they did after the Sultan's departure. For 2 years, from 1953 to 1955, cities like Casablanca find themselves consumed in chaos and unrest. Moroccans, feeling let down by both their own leaders and the colonial powers, start to revolt. The Sultan's exile is unbearable. The French thought by sending Sidi Mohammed away they would calm things down, where they certainly didn't, because it had the opposite effect entirely. Instead of calming things down, it turned him into a hero. People started calling out for the return of Sidna, and there's where the legend of Sidna was created. He embodied autonomy and self-governance being stripped away from Morocco. Now, while the people still loved the old Sultan, they weren't too thrilled with the new leadership. There were multiple attempts on Mohammed bin Arafa's life on multiple occasions. Mohammed Khams' return is decided upon a council that reunites on October 15. A week later, he's asked a question that holds the key to his return from exile. If they were to allow him back in the country, will he agree to silence the Istiqlal opposition, to which he responds by giving them a resolute nod, essentially signaling his willingness to comply as long as it means he gets to return. Purely strategic, of course, and from there things start escalating for the better. Just 3 days later, the Glawi publicly announces his support of Sultan Sidi Muhammad bin Yusuf, said he now believed him to be the only one, and I'm quoting him, who could fix the mess, a news that came as a surprise and a shock to the Moroccan people. Everyone's holding their breath. But soon enough, a wave of relief was washing over the entire country, like a burden had been lifted off the nation's shoulders. Then it was Moulay ibn Arafa's turn to extend an olive branch, urging all Moroccans, himself, to rally behind his deposed cousin, Mohamed bin Youssef. And as the last act, Edgar Faure, the French Prime Minister at the time, decided to intervene and trying to sort this mess out with the only possible issue to end the Sultan's exile, signing the Declaration of La Salle Saint-Cloud on November the 6th, 1955. A couple days prior, Mohamed bin Youssef had landed in the French coastal city of Nice, setting the stage for a crucial meeting with Antoine Pinet, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, on November the 6th in La Salle Saint-Cloud, where the document is signed. It was precisely there that they cemented the principle of Moroccan independence, opening a new chapter in the nation's history. The following day, the Glawi arrives, seeking forgiveness from the Sultan, symbolizing the shifting tides of power in Morocco. Now, on Wednesday, November 16, 1955, Sidi Mohamed and his family return to Morocco at last. As they land, pictures are taken of them, showcasing an absolutely ecstatic crowd buzzing with Moroccans of all ages in the airport of Rabat Slah. And among the crowd, Touria was right there, part of the welcoming committee. But there's a twist. She didn't just stand on the sidelines, she made a bold move by greeting him from the cockpit of her plane. As everyone is having a party on the ground, Touria takes to the skies to greet the royal family. She didn't do it as a way to showcase her flying skills, as she no longer had anything to prove, really. She was very secure in her reputation as a talented pilot, but really the point was to make this historical moment as memorable as she could. It held deeper significance. She did it as a way to breathe life into Morocco's struggle for independence, to light up the city with patriotism, to gather everyone around a common exhale of relief upon the Sultan's return, which was symbolizing the beginning of an end, the end for European occupation. The crowd that was gathered to witness the spectacle was captivated by Touria's quite acrobatic maneuvers as she was flying over the Touarga neighborhood in Casablanca, dropping welcoming leaflets as she raided the city. Her performance was really one for the books, to say the very least. So up until now, everything sounded good, but every good story has its fair share of skeletons in the closet. She wasn't spared for her young age by life. On the contrary, it made her easier of a target. She faces multiple assassination attempts. It is 1954 and Touria Chaoui is living her life fearlessly, but there's a dark shadow lurking in the background, the shadow of those who couldn't stand to see her rise. According to the historian Le Marini's tale, the first attempt on her life unfolds like a scene truly from a spy movie, if you want my opinion. A bomb, planted by a group of French terrorists, ticks ominously at the door of her villa on Alexandre Mali Street. Luckily, that day, she survives. But for how long? Because later that same year, danger strikes again. This time, it's gunfire tearing through the silence of a December night. 8 bullets spit from an automatic machine gun, aimed straight at her. Yet miraculously, again, not a single one finds its mark. It's as if fate itself is shielding her from harm. But I repeat my question, how long for? Because then comes the third attempt, unfolding in the heat of August 1955. 2 French policemen, their faces twisted with hatred, ambush her while she's literally in her car with her mother. Sure, a part of the French forces relentlessly went after her, but Touria found her biggest enemies within her own people. A lot of Moroccans didn't like what she was embodying as much as the French did. Her brilliance was haunting them like a ghost. They couldn't bear to see her thrive. They couldn't bear the thought of losing control over the narrative, over the pen that was redefining or defining simply societal norms. And tragically, their pursuit catches up with her in 1956. At just 19 years old, as she's preparing to embark on, you know, another journey the next day, the last attempt succeeds, claiming her life. The scene I described in the beginning of the podcast has every trait of a tragedy. March the 1st, 1956, as she was just starting to carve out a historical legacy for women in her country, the young pilot's promising journey was tragically cut short by an act of the most evil violence on the eve of the independence treaty signing. She was fatally shot at close range while sitting beside her little brother Salah al-Din in a car. Historical sources point to a man named Ahmed Toil as the perpetrator, a man that was known for his shady past within resistance circles. A troubled soul, sure, but who guided his hand? Because one thing's for sure in this tangled tale, he wasn't acting alone. In fact, Turiya's death was no accident. It was a deliberate attempt to erase her from history's pages. But whose agenda did this serve? Speculation started swirling regarding the motive behind her murder. Some suggested it was a vendetta among nationalists, especially since just before the incident, Alel Fassi himself, which we talked about earlier, had advised the Chaoui family to leave the country ASAP temporarily. Rumors also hinted that Ahmed Touil may have killed Touria out of jealousy or love or both, something he had feelings for her. Yet, beyond suspicions and historical conjecture, the truth behind this assassination remains wrapped in a mystery veil. And that is exactly what the assassins wanted, whoever it was. Ahmed Touil himself was murdered shortly after, and the case went cold, leaving Touria's family in perpetual mourning. The unresolved murder left a lasting scar on her brother Salah al-Din, and rightfully so, who witnessed his elder sister's death. Taking the advice of their nationalist quote-unquote friends, the family relocated, and eventually he chose to leave Morocco and settle in France. According to Al-Hijoumri, a secretary to the Royal Academy, many of these men who were giving the young girl a hard time, or that would literally gravitate towards her in the nationalist circles like a bunch of hungry flies, were secretly, in their emotional solitude, in love with her. He says, and I quote, "She represented for us the determined entrance of our society into the modernity of the century, and its definitive break from close-mindedness, obscurantism, and ideological despotism." Touria Chaoui's life was one of a kind, a success story followed by a thriller, with danger lurking around every corner. From the heights of success, fulfillment, and adulation, to the depths of danger, political intrigue, and betrayal, she faced it all with guts and grace until it got the best of her. When the dust settled, she was gone, a victim of jealousy, cowardice, insecurity, and instability. Yet, her legacy has to live on, which is why I'm making this episode. I'm glad you made it here, by the way, to the end, and don't hesitate to come say hi on my Instagram, at Aya Shukri, if you did. So here's to Touria, the fearless flyer who dared to rewrite the script of Moroccan identity, paying the ultimate price for her audacity.